And then something bigger, I could feel something bigger present. And I remembered what Suzuki said, which is, exhale into emptiness. To take care of the exhalation is very important. To die is more important than to be alive. To die is more important than to be alive, because we're letting go with the out-breath into emptiness. So I also began to feel the letting go of the out-breath. And then Suzuki also said, calmness of mind is beyond the end of the exhalation. I don't know, I've just been doing this, and I've come to appreciate that this breath practice is living the Dharma. Because in the inhale and the exhale, impermanence is real. When I know that I'm inhaling my breath, the air, oxygen's coming from the plants. And when I exhale, my carbon dioxide is received from the plants. So even from that basic level, everything's interconnected. But also, the exhale is about letting go of whatever it is that's happening, whatever it is that I'm thinking about. So I began to see that just our breath, how we live breathing, if we're with it, we're living the Dharma. So it's kind of a paradox, because I feel like this is sort of like an act of resistance in some way. Like I don't want to leave my body out of fear or out of despair. I want to be in my body. I want to be fully alive. And somehow this breath practice has become also like standing up or something like that. I don't know, we can offer our breath to the Buddha. Remember, we're all breathing together. So many of you know that some of us just returned from a 4-day retreat at Gringalch Farm. Our Wild Women's, our third annual Wild Women's Retreat. And it was a very rich time. And one of the things that we have done now is what we call koan theater. So on Saturday, we broke up into small groups, and each group was given a koan, and their task was to discover together how to actually dramatize the koan. So I call this embodied study, because you had to be in your body and actually expressing the koan, you know, to understand it, really. So you could probably all know, who've worked with koans, that the koans are mostly dialogues between students and teachers, or students and students and teachers and teachers. And the koans are there to speak to the undivided mind. So there's a transformation process, if we engage the koan, of awakening to this undivided mind interpenetrating with our situation, with our life as it is. So I was reading some of the Genjo Koan by Okamura, and I was really interested in how he interpreted the kanji for an, or koan, A-N. And according to Okamura, Dogen's meaning is hand. And means hand, like to press or push with a finger or a hand, as if you're massaging our being in a very gentle way, to push, but gently, like if you were giving someone a massage, to activate the healing that's there given to us in this koan. So what I want to do tonight is to share one of the koans that we worked on, Seven Wise Women in the Charnel Ground. And this koan was written in the 9th century in China. And I was very interested. I didn't know till recently that at that time in the Tang Dynasty, women, many were priestesses. The attitudes towards women at that time were very different than in some of the other Asian countries. There was a belief within Taoism that women have transcendental abilities to communicate with the deities. They believed in women's inner alchemy, and they offer practices to maintain good health. So in this time period, when this koan was offered in a public way, a third of the clergy were women. So that's just powerful to know, I think. So what I'm going to do is read the text in segments. And I'm going to invite all of us to enter into the story as if we're with the women in the charnel ground. We'll be like accompanying them and sensing what you might experience if we went together into the charnel ground. Because the important thing is that these seven wise women went together to this charnel ground. And so we too can go together and accompany them. So I'm going to be reading a segment and then give you some of my reflections, but also offer to invite you to just sense what comes up for you as if you're there walking in a charnel ground. And we all are already walking in our own charnel grounds, you know, where difficult aspects of life are experienced. So, but I want to caution you because something might start to happen while you're doing this. Like you might, your mind might start going into the future. Like, well, how is this going to end? Or what's the punchline of this koan? You know, that you'll find your mind wanting to think about it rather than to stay present in the uncertainty of what's unfolding, because we don't know. And in that uncertainty, notice if there's resistance even. Maybe you don't want to go on this journey. But just notice all of this. Everything is welcome, and everything is for us to learn from. So, does that make sense? Okay. Okay, so here's the first part of the text. Seven wise sisters planned a spring journey. One of them said, "Sisters, instead of going to a park to enjoy the spring flowers, let's go together to see the charnel grounds." The other said, "That place is full of decaying corpses. What is such a place good for?" The first woman said, "Let's just go. Very good things are there. Let's just go." So here we go, entering the charnel ground. And what's important is that we're going together. So I'm imagining stepping onto the grounds of a cemetery, looking around, feeling kind of disoriented, so many gravestones, recently dug out, you know, plots to lower the deceased into. Maybe there's a crematorium there, but so many all around. And maybe there's corpses laying fresh on the ground. Someone may be suffering from very recent grief. The death of her husband, for example, might be raw. And maybe she's wandering around saying, "Get me out of here. I can't deal with this." Feeling frantic. But even though we're all here together, so it's our presence that's going to make it possible, give us courage to let whatever thoughts come arise, memories, emotions, maybe questions might arise. So just notice. I'm remembering that my paternal grandmother died when I was 3 months old. My dad was full of grief because he wasn't there when she died. So for many years as a child, we would visit her gravesite regularly as a family. I remember, especially when I was just three, and while I was there in the cemetery, I played. I just ran around and ran between the gravestones, and I felt so light and free. And I really sense I felt a kind of stillness there that I'd never felt before. So it was very profound, really. But then I'm remembering, too, many years later when my father died, it took me 3 years to go to his gravesite. My mother needed all the attention for her grief. So finally I said, I'm going to go look for his gravesite. I didn't even know where it was. But I said, Mom, you can't come. It came to me today because I forgot that when we couldn't find the gravesite for a long time, we walked around and around, and it was really overwhelming. And then finally we found my dad's gravestone, but then it was also his wife, my grandmother, it was his father, it was another great-grandfather, like all of a sudden this whole family of my ancestors were there. It was only then that I could grieve. But receive what's coming gently, because maybe the women, maybe us, as we're walking around, we could start talking to each other. Maybe we're in the whispers because we're in a graveyard, we're sharing what's coming up for us. The women are mature practitioners. There's no judgment. There's no giving advice, just being present. But even so, right here, we're facing the truth of aversion as a human tendency to turn away from something that's painful or threatening. Oftentimes, we don't even notice aversion. It can come so quickly. Like I remember, and this is embarrassing, but this was, well, a while ago, but a colleague died, and I decided not to go to the funeral. And it's only now that I look back that, oh, what was that? You know, I thought I was just, you know, it's just too much. I'm taking care of myself. I felt fine. But no, I was turning away. I was holding on to a sense of self, whereas turning towards means that we begin to let go. I came upon this poem by McCrick Ladbdron, who's a yogin and a teacher in 11th century Tibet. And he said this about aversion. Confess your hidden faults. Approach what you find repulsive. Help those you think you cannot help. Anything you are attracted to, let it go. Anything you're attracted to, let it go. And go to the places that scare you. Remember, at first, most of the women rejected this whole idea of going to the charnel grounds. But one woman said, very good things are there. But maybe after a while, as the women have started to talk to each other and connect, they began to realize something deeper is happening here. That maybe whatever it is, it's not really personal anymore. I don't know. I think it's sort of like You know, you can listen to the frogs croaking at night, and they're all singing in harmony, and then all of a sudden, they all stop singing at the same time. I kind of felt like this, that maybe there was sort of a hush that came over the women all at once, and they all stopped and began to sense, you know, a whole different, like, energy that was moving around them. You know, they were paying attention to the life there in a different way. They weren't concentrating on their own personal issues anymore. They were feeling this sacred energy of the mystery of life and death. And this sense of energy brought them close. And as this energy was emanating, you could feel it. And they came and ended up drawing closer, pulled in by this energy to gather around a naked corpse lying on the ground, not yet buried in the earth. They sensed that they were pulled there. And so here's the text again. Someone said, "There is a person's body. Where's the person gone?" "What?" another sister said. "What did you say?" "There's a person's body. Where has the person gone?" And all seven sisters were immediately awakened. Together, immediately awakened. Maybe it's palpable. Death is real. Everything is impermanent. We all die. There's no escape. This naked, decaying corpse isn't just one body, it's all bodies. And you can maybe sense, maybe in yourselves too, that fear is released as compassion arises for everyone. Because we're all, this is the truth about all of us. And such a letting go, almost a release into the out-breath. And together they were witnessing this truth. So Okamura says, impermanence, seeing reality, encourages us to stop clinging to our lives and their contents. This seeing and letting go is Buddhist practice. This is how we realize the preciousness of every life, and we can then see what's needed right in front of us. So I had this sense, really, like compassion for all beings can become passionate because it's sort of a whole enlivened sense of the interconnectedness of everything. And this way, all beings are worthy of love. Each living being becomes sort of like our only child. So what is this? We know it's equality mind, this realization that even though in everyday life, you know, we suffer difficult situations, you know, some people are superior to you, some people make more money than you, all these differences of categories that divide, yet all of us live this truth of impermanence. This is the permanent truth, and this is what they all awaken to. So I was thinking lately, this truth of impermanence, can we see impermanence? You think we can see impermanence? I'm thinking of Shakespeare. Maybe you've heard this poem. "To me, fair friend, you never can be old. For as you were when first your eye I eyed, such seems your beauty still. But three winter's pride have shook the forests." I'm sorry. "Three winter's pride have shook." I'm sorry. I was sure I could do this, but I guess I'm not sure I can. "Three winter's pride shook three beautiful springs, three summers turn to yellow autumn in process of the seasons I have seen, three April perfumes in three hot Junes burned since first I saw you fresh. Ah, yet beauty like a dial hand steals from its figure with no pace perceived. So methinks your beauty is still fresh and green, but like a dial hand it steals from your figure and we don't see it. So in the poem Shakespeare ends, for fear of this truth I declare that summer's beauty is dead. So I guess this is just this way that we don't see impermanence, I don't think. It's what we see is the surface of what's really going on. And so what's impermanent in life is something that we experience at the deepest level of our meditation practice, because we live the freshness of everything that's arising and the truth that nothing stays the same, and the truth that this moment together here will be only this moment and never again. All of these we have to see below the waves of the contents of people's lives. We have to let go even of language and witness this unseen truth. And all of this just means that we also keep letting go of self. So in the impermanence, we cultivate this deep awareness that my life is not my own. Your life is not your own. And the sense of wanting to give our lives away began to arise in these women. They didn't want to hold on to self anymore. They wanted to give. They wanted to be here for the benefit of all beings. So the text goes on. Indra, Lord of the gods, was moved by their awakening, these seven sisters in the charnel ground, and showered flowers down on them. She offered them whatever they needed for the rest of their lives. One of the sisters replied, "We have everything we need, but please give us a tree without roots, some land without light or shade, in a mountain valley where a shout does not echo." So I want to just sort of make a note that right here, the whole way this koan has been languaged shifts. It moves from words that are describing to imagery, to metaphor. And this imagery is coming from the sisters. "Give us, we have everything we need. Indra, we don't need you to shower us with flowers or tell us how wonderful we are or validate us. We want a tree without roots, some land without light or shade, and a mountain valley where a shout does not echo." So Indra replies, "Ask anything else, holy ladies, and I will gladly provide it, but I don't have those things to give you." "If you don't have them," said the woman, "how can you help others liberate themselves? How can you help others liberate themselves if you don't have these gifts?" At this, Indra took the sisters to visit the Buddha. So it's kind of wonderful to wonder, could you say that? "I have everything I need. You know, I have everything I need. And now I need something else. I need a tree without roots, some land without light or shade, and a mountain valley where a shout does not echo." And it struck me that the woman said, if you don't have them, Indra, how can you help others liberate themselves? That's the question. How can you help others liberate themselves? Not me liberating you. So when the Buddha learned why they had come, he said, as far as that's concerned, Indra, none of the arhants has the slightest clue either. Only great bodhisattvas understand this matter. So he was saying, no, people who just want their own liberation, that's not it. You know, we can't give these gifts unless we're bodhisattvas. Only bodhisattvas understand this matter. My life is not my own. So I'm wanting to share with you Dogen's commentary on this koan because it's illuminating, but at the same time, I want us to not just buy into the answer, because I feel like these images want to live in us. Images can communicate not to our mental thought process. They communicate to our unconscious. They have multiple meanings. They evoke something from us. And so we don't want an answer, really. But we want to live with the images. And yet, we're going to have answers. They're going to come. And we'll share them with each other. So here's Dogen. The great Shravakas do not know the meaning of the Tathagata's unsurpassed Bodhi. He's saying this. The great Shravakas don't know the meaning of the Tathagata's unsurpassed Bodhi or awakening. Only the Bodhisattvas who are not involved in calculations gain advantage, because they understand this, but then they let go of the advantage. So Dogen is saying, no, this is not about individual liberation. This is not about being the hero. This is about offering without calculation. We freely give, not attached to outcome or trying to calculate how to help. And then Dogen says, although it is like this, I say on behalf of Indra, so you want a tree without roots? The cypress tree in the garden is it. So Dogen's saying, a tree without roots is the cypress tree in the garden. And I don't know, I just learned that cypress trees are known all over the world. They're considered the most adaptable tree that exists, that it can grow in almost any condition, any environment. It's that flexible, that hardy, that resilient. And that also the cypress tree contains natural oils that resist decay and insects and corrosion. So Dogen's saying, you know, a tree without roots is cultivating this inner capacity for flexibility, for openness, for adaptability, for responsiveness and hardiness. And I love that he says it's in your garden. It's like, well, where is your garden? Are you taking care of your garden? And is there a cypress tree in your garden? You know, maybe this is the gift. But it still doesn't quite say, well, what do you mean a tree without roots? I mean, I think cypress trees must have a few roots, I'm not sure. But but what does that mean? And so my thought is that maybe roots have to do with our roots. Our roots are our social conditioning, our past experiences, the patterns that we've developed to cope with difficulties. But to not have roots means that we're free. We're no longer caught and attached to our past or to you know, the things that we've learned that are our hindrances. So, and then Dogen goes on to say, do you want land without north or south? This is Dogen. He says, it's the charnel ground. It is the charnel ground. That's where all of this is brought to life, what we're talking about. You know, the impermanence, the interconnectedness, the letting go of self, all of this is what allows us to enter into the bodhisattva path. But he says, if you cannot use that, if you can't think of it as the charnel ground, then the entire world is it. The entire world in the ten directions is this land without north or south. So he's cutting through all the dualities and dropping us into a place of open space. And then finally Dogen says, do you want a valley where shouts do not echo? Dogen says, shout out, sisters, to the seven wise women. If the women respond, immediately say to them, I have given you a valley without echoes. And if they don't respond, tell them, after all, it doesn't echo. A valley where shouts do not echo. What might that mean? Well, I don't know. Echo could mean, well, echoes are what comes back to you. Like if you shout into the canyon and you hear your voice coming back, it kind of gives back to you maybe, I don't know, an insight about yourself, or it gives back to you self-talk, like you're doubting things, or you're being self-critical, or you're rehearsing how you wish you'd said this or that, or, you know, all of that is sort of shouting back, which it stops us. It stops us from being able to keep going with this open gift of the bodhisattva that is always coming forth within us. So, I don't know. I'm going to be interested in what's come up for all of you, but I feel that this koan is giving us the medicine that allows us to freely act from wisdom and compassion every day in our lives. So maybe the message is, don't waste your life. Step out into this very moment. Exhale into emptiness. Embrace our interconnectedness. Let go of the heroic path and walk together, sharing our vulnerabilities, entering the stillness of the awakened mind. Turn towards what you don't want to see, and together vow to live for the benefit of all beings. I just want to say one more thing, which is that it's also true that we're unique beings, so there is no one bodhisattva path, that we're creating that path from who we are in our lives right now, but also that if we get out of the heroic journey and listen to each other and be vulnerable, it's kind of amazing. Like when we were at the guest house at Green Gulch Farm, they have a little kitchen, and you know, there were supposed to be paper towels that you use to wipe your hands and stuff, and the paper towels were gone. There weren't any. So I went into the storage place and I looked around. I couldn't see any, and I went to Karen and I said, Karen, I can't find any paper towels. And Karen went back into the storage bin and there were the paper towels. So I figured four eyes are much better than two. So, anyway, thank you for listening, and I'm hoping that there's time just to hear what's come up for you or questions you have. Or there's a lot of people on Zoom. Yes. Cedar Rose.
The land that we stay at in Minnesota.
Oh. Where's? Okay, here it comes. I don't see it.
Thank you. The land that we stay on in Minnesota, there is a big rock, and there's a cedar tree that grows on the rock, and they're, the roots are just, they're just kind of like the branches. I mean, there are hardly any roots, and the girls always run off and climb Cedar Rock.
Cedar Rock, and that's her name, too. Wow. So that's even more truth about the cedar tree, that the roots are also flexible and it finds a rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the cedar is related to the cypress.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, Kenny.
Thank you for your talk. I just had a question about the heroic path. I thought bodhisattvas were Buddhist heroes, but I don't know. Huh. I've never heard. Could you explain what is the heroic path that we're letting go of in exchange for this other path? Or?
Well, I guess what I mean is that we can still get caught into thinking it's me. It's up to me. And kind of evaluate our activity or what we do based on that kind of, I guess, template of, you know, I did something extraordinary or hard or all of that. Whereas I feel like the emphasis on doing this together, that no one person can, whether you're, you know, an advanced bodhisattva or not, we're all, you know, participating in something bigger, and the more we are practicing together, the more powerful perhaps what we have to offer can be, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But you might have a different meaning for that, so I want to make room for what you feel is that word might fit, heroic. No, okay.
Oh, what am I supposed to say? No, I've been raised on rugged individualism, and your heroes are good things, and I just haven't heard anyone. Perhaps maybe you're against the grand narratives or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, right.
We're all doing it together.
Right, right. It's in our zeitgeist, the rugged individual. Mm-hmm. Right. But that's partly why I think we can get overwhelmed, too, with hearing the cries of the world, if we kind of think of it that way, whereas if we think we can't do it alone. It's a we, not an I. Thank you for your question. Oh, I can't see. Oh, Jim. Hello, Jim.
Hello. Good evening.
I'm sorry. I got to turn the phone.
Can you hear me?
Oh.
Okay, I think now we can hear you.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, thank you for your talk. I thought, well, of course, you know, today, at least in America and modern countries, we don't have charnel grounds, but we, you know, we do, of course, have cemeteries, and I was thinking about the nun who said, you know, wonderful things are happening there, or you know, this is a good place to go, and
yeah.
and what makes it a good place to go, it seemed to me, is that it draws out a certain behavior in people. And people don't go there to be boisterous or effusive or make a big disturbance. They usually go and pay their respects. People are there to be respectful and quiet. And that in itself is such a wonderful, you know, that in itself, you know, in our cemeteries is that at least there is such a place, like a church is too, where people's behavior is altered by the place itself. They respond to the place. And so that there's a, I feel like, yeah, there's a, an interdependence there with the land and the trees that are there and the environment that's there, that draws out and interacts with us so that we're respectful and that we're quiet and that we and even unspiritual people say are altered by going to such a place and there's some feeling of reverence that will arrive. So it does call out something in people to experience the place where life, you know, has come to an end for so many beings and to experience that actually, you know, this is a very peaceful, quiet, you know, place and a place it calms people down. So I think that initial insight on the part of the person was something that that registered with me. But also your commentary and bringing out Dogen's commentary on the interaction with Indra, very interesting. Thank you for that as well.
Welcome. Well, yes, I think it's some kind of profound mystery, really, the peace that's there, you know, with death so real and, you know, sort of a gift of the mystery, because there's life there in this sense of the calm and the peacefulness that will change how people go forth in their lives, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim. Oscar.
Hi, Darley. I was interested, excuse me, I was interested in the experiences you described early in the talk about sitting or standing or whatever you may be doing, but kind of feeling that you were in the moment. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about it. How that experience relates to the charnel ground imagery or story.
I'm not sure which experience you're referring to that I was sharing. You mean the about the breathing or no?
Breathing was part of it. You mentioned that you that at times you felt as I think you said it was like you were sitting, but just in the middle of the day this would happen to you and you would be aware of your breathing and your body and mm-hmm. other things and then from there I think you went into segued into a story about your father's death and mm-hmm. other things, but I'm I had a sense that that those experiences you were having recently, I think, led you into that into the Seven Sisters story or related to that story.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could say a little more about that relationship or not.
Yes. Give me a moment. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess for me, the breath experiences that I was having that brought me so intimate with, breathing in, breathing out, everything's always moving and changing, and no matter what's happening, I guess this is what's happening on another level. And so whatever ways I might be overwhelmed by problems, the breathing itself is like an opening. But at the same time, there's life and death in that, because every time we exhale, we're letting dying, we're letting go, and into the uncertainty, into the emptiness. And that letting go is, could be very scary, and sometimes it is for me, actually. But it's also a letting go into something that's beyond my own personal life or beyond who I think I am. And that I felt like in the graveyard experiences, that was part of what was, I think, evolving for the women, that they shared their personal lives with each other. But then that was sort of like the beginning, or that was, like getting attuned to each other's suffering. But after that, then the energies began to shift, because being in the graveyard, as Jim was so articulate about, is experiencing the peace and the mystery, and somehow this is sacred space, even though, this is where people who have died are staying and aren't there anyway. They said, where did the person go? They're not even there. So, I mean, all of that is given to us. That's a gift that's given as we move through that sense of something bigger is here than my personal life. I don't know if that makes sense.
A gift that's given. Yes, thank you very much.
Michael?
Yeah, so the idea of the charnel grounds and seeing that as a sacred space where you can find good things in that. Is it possible also to find a sacred space prior to death, but also right in the place of illness and aging? Mm-hmm. Is there an equivalent of eternal grounds in that, mm-hmm. that we can be in and find peace in that too? Mm-hmm. I know that's also a place that in our culture we really shy away from, aging and illness. Mm-hmm.
Well,
push that away, but
I think maybe you're sharing your perspective on that. It's not exactly a question, really, because it sounds like you already have been living some of that, as you're confronting your aging, or maybe someone dear to you is sick, or all of that. At every juncture, something is happening that quickens us into, that deeper truth about life and death and impermanence. And but here's the place for the compassion, we don't have to be afraid anymore. We can be compassionate to ourselves, to each other, because this is human existence. This is what we're all going through.
Yeah, and in that season too, is there a way to really be with that, the illness and aging, much like when you're in the season of fall and you're just sitting there looking at the leaves turning red and gold and all that, and you really feel that beauty in that of that fall. Mm-hmm. Are there ancient traditions in which people sit with the sick and the aging and sort of honor that moment mm-hmm. itself too, mm-hmm. much like the trauma grounds? Is there mm-hmm. is there a tradition in that, or is there
I can't really give you references, but yes, I think yes. I think there's certainly in many tribal cultures, especially, a deep reverence for the dying and the sick, and how to be with those, with people in those moments, and the ceremonies and the chanting and all of that. And we need more of that. That's why we have the Jiso garden here, because that is one way that we can come together and have a more honoring of, you know, losses or, you know, heartbreaks and people who are sick, people who have died. Yes, Jody.
Just a comment on the last thing. Hospice is also a place in modern life where there's, you know, people are engaged in caring for the sick and the dying. And they have many profound experiences, which they have shared in books and other things and stuff too. So, but I was thinking about the breathing also, and you know, breath work's very powerful, right? But then I was also thinking about the valley without the echo. So it was kind of like there's the breath work in the body, and then there's a valley without an echo. So it's like a valley without air. Because if there's no echo, there's no air, right? So
you can't have air and no echo.
Maybe, but
can you have air and no echo? I mean, if you assume we're not just talking about the literalness of it,
right? But, yeah, it may be a little bit too literal,
Sorry, go ahead. You're wondering about that.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, and just if there's a relationship between, you know, there's always the negation, right? So there's the breath work, and then maybe the valley thing is like a negation. I don't know. I don't know.
Or the exhale, maybe. I don't know. It's a big question. Thank you for it, though.
People up there who are in line first.
Oh, okay. Rosie?
Hi, hopefully my dogs won't bark. Dorley, thank you so much for your time and your lecture and your storytelling. It's beautiful, and it really put me in a place to remember quite a few things about going to the graveyard. And I was there at the retreat, and so I didn't really pick up the richness of this koan, and I'm happy to be here now and hearing it in a different way. In my culture, the Samoan culture, I was not raised in the Samoan culture, but kind of around it and in it, and not really. There's a very close relationship with the dead. They bury their dead on their front porches in little mausoleums. And so there is a lot of time spent with the dead. And I, like you, when my father passed away, I did not want to go to the grave. I didn't want to remember him like dead and suffering and in the ground. And so I didn't go for a long time. And I had the same experience that you did, just like wandering around, looking for your relatives, just kind of like, it's a really strange feeling. And there was like, there's three trees and he's below the three. It was quite an experience, but I am attracted to graveyards. The first time that I came to Sacramento, Danny and I had moved here, and we rented, and everybody was buying houses, and I would go to the graveyard with my children, and like I had these awakenings, like, so you're above grass, like that's the blessing. I had the gimmies. I wanted a house that quieted it for me. I forgot what I was going to say. I feel like we go to see our dead or pay respects by being ourselves, because I've gone to East Lawn and roller skated, and nobody looked down on me or thought that I was that. I just thought, you know, this is such a beautiful place, and it's not like I don't respect the dead. I went and visited my friend and then roller skated around a bit, and it just made me, I don't, there's so much you can take from being around the dead. And then the part where you go with your friends, your group, is just to support you wherever you might meet your need, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, that's so freeing. It sounds like you got the such a deep message of just be yourself. And give that gift to other people too, whoever you go with to a graveyard. You know, you're both here to be yourselves, and it's very powerful. Yeah. Thank you. I think Simone has her hand raised. Hi, Simone.
Hi, I hope I don't forget. But I was going to say, I loved your talk, and it made me think of a lot of associations with death and graveyards. There's a colonial era graveyard near where I grew up, where the children and babies that died young and that are, the graves are washed away. And it's a place, a very small church, the Baptist church, and it's a place of immense peace. And you can go there and no one will be there. It's just amazing. And then wow. The experience when my husband actually died at the Zen hospice, and how for that month I had no fear of death. I could face everything. I could face the other residents. I felt very healthy and kind of like it wasn't touching me. But as far as the koan goes, I kind of made up a story that the women wandered to the charnel grounds and they faced the worst. Or the most acute truth, and became awakened, and they didn't want to go back to the relative realm or whatever. So they wanted to go to some kind of magical realm. So I thought of like Tushita Heaven, which I don't really quite know, Pure Land, or Shangri-La, as was depicted in the movie Lost Horizon. They wanted to go to a magical place where they wouldn't have to come back or something. So that's all. Those are my thoughts. And I just
how wonderful that you let yourself, you know, engage the koan enough to imagine a story for those women. And I mean, I find myself too, like going back and saying, well, how did these women know to ask those questions? You know, where can you find a valley where you don't hear an echo? I mean, how they were the ones that brought that up. No one else did. And I thought that was really kind of amazing. Like, you know, maybe your experience there, women, you know, gave them the bodhisattva realization. They received it already, in a way. That's my story I'm making up.
Aren't there a lot of magical images, like in the Lotus Sutra or something? I could just see a floating tree or something. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, that's all. Thanks.
Thank you. Daniel.
Yeah, so, thank you. And for me, I thought of a lot of things, all of which pertain to the great matter, which has always been, you know, the biggest thing for me. But immediately with this koan, when you were telling it tonight, seven sisters went to the charnel ground. I said, oh, my God, the smell. And
wow.
And I said to myself, I went back and I missed the middle of your koan because I found myself reminiscing. Uh-huh. And that's when I was in high school sometime and my sister was in medical school. And so one day she took me and a few of my siblings, one of whom ironically is now dead himself, but she took us to tour her medical school. And she took us to what was known as the cadaver room, which, you know, they did all the dissections and whatnot. And still to this day, I can recall looking into that room and what I saw in terms of cross dissection. And it was a special place. It was a sacred place. It was a place of learning. And we were respectful. And I remember what I was seeing. And I remember that the door opened and being struck with such a smell of formaldehyde that I was stolen in the breath. And, you know, for me tonight, when I'm hearing this koan, that brings back to me somewhat of a sense of embarrassment and shame, because I had to turn away at that point when I was met by the smell.
By the smell. Well, right. It can be that visceral, though. So an aversion, you know, like a horrible smell, or, you know, just seeing something disgusting, or, and... Yeah.
And to see and smell it right here and now.
Well, I appreciate that you can sort of confess, you know. That's part of what this is about, you know, all the ways that we do turn away and how hard it is not to, and how we might do it and not even realize it. And, you know, it's all of what this is inviting us to, I guess, just pay attention to. Thank you, Daniel.